Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to this lecture in the Senate Department's occasional lecture series. Today we're back to the subject of federalism. Back in the 50s and 60s, as one historian said, federalism was regarded as a shabby halfway house on the road to true national union. Then we seem to have a bit of a revival of appreciation of the value of federalism, but now we seem to be lurching back to centralism again. Probably as a result of current economic difficulties and so on. One of the areas most controversial about federalism is its economic aspects. And today we have here an expert on that subject, Professor Jonathan Pincus, who's going to talk about competitive federalism, one of the aspects of federalism that was always regarded as one of its great advantages. Please welcome him to the podium.
Thank you very much for the kind introduction and the invitation to speak here. I understand that copies of this speech will be available at the end. In a publication for the Committee for Economic Development of Australia about a year and a half ago, I argued that Australian federalism is in rough good health. It could be improved, and there are serious threats to its fruitful operation, but by and large, the Australian federal system of government has worked well. Along the way, it's achieved a reasonable balance between centralisation of government functions and decentralisation of them, and a reasonable balance between cooperation between governments and competition between them. And it's concern about the maintenance of that balance that motivates me today. Distinctive feature of federalism is that it introduces a new form of intergovernmental competition. It's not that it introduces a new form of intergovernmental cooperation. We don't need political federalism in order to achieve intergovernmental cooperation. An example is you can mail a letter in Australia with an Australian stamp. It's delivered in any country in the world by the postal service of that country, without additional stamps being required. NATO, North Atlantic Treaty Organisation, delivers cooperation on some defence matters without there being a single political federation between the members. So today I'm going to focus on the competitive angle of federalism because I believe there's dangers that it will be lost if there's insufficient appreciation of its value or potential value. All governments are subject to competition. Some forms of intergovernmental competition, like war, are horrid, but some are conducive to good social and economic outcomes. The best arrangement is to have a formal constitution and informal political traditions that encourage good competition. A vertical competition is the top level of competition within a federation, and it's a competition unique to federations. In Australia, it's competition between the Commonwealth government on the one hand and the government of the states and territories on the other. It's a form of intergovernmental competition for the affiliation and support of citizens and voters, and it's manifest in competitive offerings promised and hopefully fulfilled. It's unique because the two levels of sovereign government in a federation simultaneously rule over the same piece of geography. That's what a federated nation is. Today, I'll argue that Australians should welcome and improve competition between governments in a range of matters. However, many politicians and political commentators want to limit intergovernmental competition within Australia, and especially to eliminate vertical competition between the states and the Commonwealth. The goal that's often announced is, as Mr. Rudd has said, to eliminate the blame game that can occur when more than one government is responsible for a role or a function. The The blame game between governments will only end when the Commonwealth does everything. Australians would then face a monopoly form of government, and citizens would have fewer avenues through which to encourage government to perform well. Let me have a final introductory remark before I get to the substance. Neither today nor elsewhere do I call upon states' rights. I come from a family of lawyers, and lawyers tell me that states have rights, and I believe them. But I prefer to regard governments as means to ends and not as ends in themselves, and therefore any rights that states may have should derive from the rights and responsibilities of the citizens concerned. So let me get to the substance of the paper. I'm going to talk for a bit about competition and monopoly. Government is a means of getting done collectively some important things that otherwise would be done very badly, like external defence or domestic law and order, or maybe wouldn't get done at all. What level of government should be given the task of, say, running public hospitals or running TAFEs? Should it be the Australian government, state or territory government, local government? Well, I can make a strong case that only one level of government, the Commonwealth, should be providing national defence. For the money, and I'm an economist, seven state navies would be much less effective than one national navy. But what is it about public hospitals or TAFE colleges or a whole range of issues that make them a case suitable for control by a single government? When, that is, should one level of government have a monopoly? The opposite of monopoly is competition. It took 6 or 7 decades after federation for the idea to be accepted by Australian opinion makers and politicians that vigorous competition amongst businesses and regulated competition in the professions are, by and large, forces for the social good. The Secretary of the Treasury, Dr. Ken Henry, has called attention to, and I quote, a community sensitivity to market-determined prices and also quantities, that is, a sensitivity to market-determined patterns of resource allocation. I interpolate, this sensitivity, Secretary Henry went on to say, and I quote again, was a barrier to the development of efficient markets that is at least as old as government, end of quote. So although it's the case that Australian opinion leaders and politicians mostly now accept that regulated market competition is a force for the social good, there is some scepticism about that amongst the general public. And there's even more scepticism that intergovernmental competition removed from the market can deliver net social benefits. So I've got a tough assignment today to convince you at least there's something in it. So I turn to vertical competition. As recently as 2008, Secretary of the Treasury, Ken Henry, wondered at what he calls, and I'll quote again, a startling new concept of vertical competitive federalism. That is, competition between the Commonwealth on the one hand and the states and territories on the other, end of quote. Actually, vertical competitive federalism is a concept that's hardly new, and the practice has been going on probably since federation. But let me give you one recent example. The Rudd government has moved to implement its electoral promises, including a reduction in waiting lists for elective surgery. The states had not succeeded in delivering waiting lists that were acceptable to many voters, and so Mr. Rudd made an election promise to do better. Well, this is a clear example. It's a clear example of vertical competition between the Commonwealth and the states and territories. It's competition for the support of voters in an area of service traditionally regarded as the responsibility of the states, that is, the states own and run public hospitals. Vertical competition leads to blurring of responsibilities. Who will be responsible for public hospital waiting lists or public hospitals generally? States or the feds? Who is responsible for the supply of supermarket groceries, Coles or Woolies? Very few people would argue that Australia would be better served by a monopoly grocery chain than by competition. However, many believe that Australia would be better served by a clear and unassignable assignment of government responsibilities within a federation. That is, a bit of monopoly. Such a clear assignment means the end of vertical competitive federalism, an end to the blurring of responsibilities, an end to overlap of their domain with its duplication. So just as competition amongst private companies and firms safeguards consumers against high prices and shoddy goods and services, so competition amongst governments can help safeguard citizens against bad government and encourage good government. Democratic government exists to serve its people with their common as well as their very diverse interests and perspectives. In democracy, competition is required to ensure high quality of service by government. And I'll talk a bit about competition in other spheres later. Intergovernmental competition requires that governments have capacity for uncooperative and independent action. Now, the complete abolition of the states, I think, is unlikely to occur anytime soon. However, what started many decades ago is an effective sidelining of the states. If this continues to gather pace, the states will end up no more independent of the Commonwealth than our local governments independent of their own state and territory governments. However, if the states and territories become mere service agencies of the Commonwealth, this will not put an end to the blame game. To repeat myself, the blame game will end only when the Commonwealth does everything. Otherwise, when things go wrong, the states will say, "Don't blame us, blame the Commonwealth. The Commonwealth refuses to pay us enough to do the job." And besides, the Commonwealth hamstrings us by regulating working conditions in hospitals or in schools or universities or whatever. Federal government forays into areas of policy or services that were formerly occupied solely or wholly by the states are often described in terms of national priorities and national goals. However, I can't believe it that it's a matter of considerable importance to people living in Western Australia what the waiting lists are in New South Wales, and I can't believe that it's of considerable importance, it's a national matter, to people in New South Wales what their shopping hours are in Western Australia. Yet these are both things that are supposed to be national goals. And although the process of the Council of Australian Governments seems to me superior to the Premier's Conference and the Loans Council, which it's replaced, there is still a hint of the strong-arm tactics of the Commonwealth. You remember the story about the offer being pushed under the door. Well, it doesn't happen, but there still is a strong-arm tactic. Implicitly, agree with what we say are national priorities and goals, or else. Some people call this coercive federalism. Now, earlier I said that Mr. Rudd's election promise to reduce hospital waiting lists is an example of vertical competition. But this kind of competition, if used more widely, is unlikely to produce systematically good outcomes. I'll switch to markets to make my analogy. In regulated markets, this kind of competition is called cherry picking. It occurs when a supplier enters into a regulated market very selectively, supplying only those things that have high payoffs and low costs, and leaving to the established suppliers the task of supplying everything else that the regulations required to be supplied. And the notion is, states have an agreement with the Commonwealth about hospitals, Commonwealth comes in and says, "Oh, we'll do the things with low cost and high payoff." It's a kind of behaviour that public schools complain about, namely that a private school can find ways not to accept students who are costly to teach, knowing that public schools must take them. If it is a national goal to have better hospitals generally, then this kind of selective intervention seems a poor way to achieve it. The states have arrangements, maybe good, maybe bad, for managing hospitals. So I look around, I see many public institutions with more than one government master, universities with state charters, but within the Commonwealth's unified national system. Schools that report to state education's of department, but also to the Commonwealth. Local governments that are creatures of the states, but are partly funded by the Commonwealth and therefore responsible to, in some sense, the Commonwealth. Indigenous organisations similarly. These arrangements mean that the managers of these institutions do not have single line manager, to use the jargon that I learnt when I worked for 6 years in the public service. The deleterious consequences of overlap of government are thereby magnified when single set of managers have more than one government master. It's possibly in response to that kind of thought that the Rudd government has threatened to take over the public hospitals from the states. The states do not shape up quickly enough. Well, say the federal government does take them over, but does it, unfortunately, a really rotten job, makes a hash. What then? Wouldn't you expect voters to reward a state government that turns around and establishes better public hospitals than those run by the Commonwealth? That again would be vertical competitive federalism in action, moving competition coming from below rather than from atop. Similarly, businesses have decried the performance of TAFE colleges in some states and territories. Vertical competition in a federation would see the Commonwealth establishing its own TAFE colleges in competition with those of the states. Then let businesses and TAFE students choose between the public providers. Vertical competition between governments is not confined to government being the provider of the services. It is in action when the Commonwealth directly funds independent schools and lets parents decide between a public provider, namely the state, public schools, and a private provider, namely an independent school funded by the Commonwealth. It would be vertical competition if the Commonwealth followed Norway and issued student vouchers to fund independent schools. The Commonwealth has advantages over the states. The main advantage the Commonwealth has in running things like hospitals or colleges is its dominant financial power. Otherwise, what is it about public hospitals that make it likely that central government will do a better job than the states? Is it a superior understanding of patients' needs, or superior ability to change how hospitals are run, or superior capacity to change hospital workforce practices? The Commonwealth has unchallenged control in a number of matters, including defence. No doubt defence is one of the most complicated and difficult areas in government, but that granted, it can hardly be said that the administration of defence has always been a brilliant success. My point's not to rubbish the Commonwealth, that's stupid. My point is to say we don't know in advance whether the Commonwealth is likely to turn out to be better than the states in running public hospitals and so on. Why not experiment with vertical competitive federalism and let the Commonwealth try its hand at running some public hospitals before moving to take them all over? Best, if it's a fair competition with all Commonwealth hospitals and all state hospitals funded through the same formula, for example, case mix funding, which began in Victoria and recently suggested by the National Health and Hospitals Reform Commission. Or even better form of competition, let the Commonwealth be the funder and not the provider, and adopt that Commission's suggested new scheme, dubbed Medicare Select, the next-gen Medicare, the voucher system that dare not speak its name, in which the patient will have more choices as to how to go about securing medical and hospital services they want and could freely choose between private and public providers. So I'll turn now to a brief discussion of competitive outcomes. Some of you may have been exposed, I at least see one person who has, to undergraduate economic textbooks, textbooks in economics, which sell enormous numbers, which tend to emphasise what is called the perfectly competitive markets, in which each business produces exactly the same product as each other business. In these circumstances, competition enforces uniformity of prices, qualities, conditions of sale. But it's mighty unusual in consumer markets for competition to result in many firms producing identical products. Standard specifications, which is what identical products look like, are less rare in markets selling intermediate products, like screws. In contrast, the struggle for the consumer dollar induces businesses to differentiate their products, to try variations that appeal to different types of customers. That is, competitors in ordinary markets tailor their products to what consumers want and are willing to pay for. The more readily the consumers will shift their custom in response to different offerings, the greater the rewards to businesses for getting it right, even if in competitive markets the rewards are often very temporary. Let me put the issues more generally. Economists, but not often in their introductory textbooks, say that the relative uniformity or diversity of products offered for sale in competitive markets is an emergent outcome. The actual outcome depends on the process that produces the outcome. Change the process from competition to something else, change the outcome. Competitive processes produce outcomes different from other processes. So in particular, there's no way for a wise person to predict accurately and systematically what the outcomes of competitive processes will be. Even people whose fortunes depend on it make mistakes. Metaphorical way to put this is to say that competitive process discovers the outcome. Now, the point of this short excursion into economics of ordinary markets is that some of its lessons applies to any competitive process. When the various state governments compete with each other, one another, the outcomes are a changing mix of uniformity and diversity. The more readily that families and firms will move across state lines in response to the social and economic environment offered by the various states, then the larger the rewards for the state to get it right, in getting it right. And the notion that outcomes emerge from processes, competitive process, gives a warning to those who, observing the similar but slightly different policies or offerings or regulations of the various states, jump to the very dangerous conclusion that there may as well be one national policy or one national regulation or one national service provider. And that the one national policy will be at least as good as the average of the slightly diverse state policies. My point is, different processes, different outcomes. You can't say, that's the outcome of this process, so we will achieve that outcome by a different process. Moreover, in competitive environments, when someone discovers a better way of doing things, when tastes of consumers change or a new class of products hits the market, then the old offerings disappear under the pressure of competition. Contrast the uniformity that can arrive from the deliberative processes of a single rational government or of a set of governments that have forsworn competition in favour of cooperation or have retired in favour of the Commonwealth. This uniformity is often the result of experts scanning the horizon for best practice, which the government adopts and then gets stuck with it. Now, I'm not pretending that the differences in across states in public schooling arrangements, in tax rules, in occupational health and safety and so on, do not impose considerable costs on families who move between states and businesses who operate in more than one state. But I do insist that these differences also bring considerable benefits, including the important benefit of being able to move to some place where things are different. Now, some of these issues are dealt with by what I think of mostly as a European notion of subsidiarity in government, so I'll talk about that. My main target today is the claim that vertical competition is strange and is always undesirable and should be eliminated. But I'm not claiming that there are no areas of public action that should be set exclusively for one level of government or the other. So I'll explain why I don't invest too much in the European Union's principle of federal subsidiarity. This principle is that a specific governmental role or function should be left with that level of government, central or decentralised, that level of government. Well, actually, it's better than that. It says the lower level of government, unless the higher level of government can handle it more effectively. You'd think I'd be really thrilled with that, being a federalist. But as a devotee of federalism, I say the subsidiarity principle is something. It's left to the lower level of government, unless the higher level of government can do it better. It's something, but it's not much. The very idea of subsidiarity is at right angles to the idea of vertical competition. Subsidiarity principle carries with it the implication or the notion that all government roles and functions should be assigned unambiguously and exclusively to one level of government or the other. So let me state rather briefly in some conditions under which there should be an exclusive, unambiguous assignment of a governmental power, role or responsibility. That is, conditions under which vertical competition is in principle undesirable. Fundamental consideration, expressed in the language of economics, is that there should be substantial economies of scale or scope, what people call synergies, that cannot be secured through contract or agreement. National defence, to repeat, is archetypical. Seven state navies aren't going to be as good as one national one. That's an economy where concentrating what you do, you get a better result for the money. An allied condition for exclusive assignment of responsibility is that the advantages of standardisation outweigh the disadvantages. Standardisation of weights and measures, for example, which are in the Australian Constitution, responsibility of the federal government, may be best achieved through government and in a federation by the central government with exclusive powers. Second kind of consideration as to when there should be exclusivity is that intergovernmental competition can sometimes lead to disastrous races to one extreme or the other. A race to the undesirable or miserable bottom, and a race to the undesirable and extravagant top. An example of the race to the top is the international arms race, nuclear arms race. Let me use tax to illustrate the race to the bottom. It's an example everybody uses. Under Premier Joh Bjelke-Petersen, Queensland sought to attract retired folk by abolishing death duties. Other states followed suit, and now Australia has no death duties. Well, death is unpopular, and so is death duties. However, most economists think that death duties are a relatively efficient form of taxation and should be included in the tax mix. On a less dramatic scale, state governments have competed to attract or retain specific businesses in their states, often by granting special exemptions or reductions in payroll or land taxes. The states, as it were, are fishing in the same pond. Whoever casts the most bait gets the most fish. The tax revenues of the state governments collectively are worsened by this form of competition, and the efficiency of the national tax system is damaged. Possibly spurred by criticism along these lines from Gary Banks from the Productivity Commission, all states except Queensland agreed to limit or cease this kind of interstate bidding war. Now, concern about the race to the bottom in the tax area leads me to lend some support to the arrangement under which the Commonwealth collects more tax revenues than it spends, and the states vice versa. And the argument's detailed in my CEDAR piece, and I can't really do it today. The result has been the Commonwealth controls taxation of personal and company income and the GST, and has responsibilities for social security payments, which the same issues retain. And the states retain their own significant tax sources and spending responsibilities. But to signal what I hope I've got time to get to, what's coming, there is a benefit for assigning these taxes exclusively, but there's a cost, and I'm going to come to that cost later on. Let me talk about some other forms of competition before I do that. Don't governments feel considerable competitive pressures of other kinds if we get rid of this vertical stuff? I'll argue that they're not quite enough. And in addition, interestingly, the same people who are sceptical about vertical competition are at least as sceptical, maybe more, about other forms of intergovernmental competition. More effort and words have been expended to reduce or eliminate horizontal competition between the states than have been made to prevent vertical competition between the states and the central government. Both forms eliminated, then that leaves electoral competition alone to do the job supported by a free press. Whenever there is government, there will be competition to become government. It's true for all kinds of government: tyrannies, hereditary monarchies, rules by theocrats, philosopher kings. All of these involve competition, sometimes bloody, to be the tyrant of the king or to represent the truth or the word of God on earth. Undoubtedly, fair electoral competition is the foundation upon which decent democratic government is based. Because Australia has no tradition of winner-take-all after a change of government, except possibly in Queensland, this nation has an enviable record of peaceful transfers of power. Federalism is a way to commit not to have winner-take-all. Combined with short electoral cycles and party stability, this is one reason why Australians have confidence in government, and the international surveys show that up. Associated with these transfers, occasion of transfer of democratic power, is party political competition, which you're all familiar with, and I won't go into it, and competition to influence party platforms, influence voters, etc. So that broad range of electoral competition associated. Is that all that we need? Is electoral competition to gain temporary control of the one and only government all that we need? Well, imagine a periodical election for the right to be monopoly supplier of groceries to all Australians. One year, Woolies wins. Next time around, Coles, maybe in alliance with IGA, wins. So on, through a series of temporarily monopolistic suppliers of groceries. Most Australians would be uncomfortable with this arrangement, fearing wouldn't be enough to discipline the suppliers, not enough to prevent price gouging and poor service. Well, if you agree on groceries, then surely the argument applies more strongly to competition amongst governments. Surely the services of government are at least as important to Australians as are the services of grocery chains. Why be content with monopoly control of public hospitals or monopoly control of school curricula or tax rates or industrial relations or business regulation? Why work to make the states completely subservient to the Commonwealth or to abolish them altogether and therefore eliminate intergovernmental competition within Australia? Australia is a federation comprising sovereign states and a sovereign central government. An Australian is simultaneously a citizen of a state or territory and a citizen of Australia. Only in a federation can a citizen look to two sovereign governments, each operating over the same piece of territory, in my case, South Australia. One level of government fails in some way, then Australian citizens can stay at home and push the other level of government to provide more of what they want. Well, you may stay at home, but there's another option. One Australian state offers what a person or family or business wants and wants it badly enough, then they can move interstate. Maybe for education, maybe because of drug laws, abortion laws, euthanasia. For businesses, maybe because of taxes and charges, the quality of infrastructure or business regulation. Well, this is horizontal competition. Until there is only one government in the world, horizontal competition between governments will occur. All Australian governments are competing with governments of other countries for population. Similarly, Woolies and Coles and IGA are competing for customers. Now, I'd rather live in a country into which many people wish to immigrate. Please don't come to South Australia. It's got enough people. Like Australia, than to live in a country from which many people want to leave, like Zimbabwe or the former East Germany. Bad government is a major problem for a long list of countries, and good government is a major source of attraction of Australia. Economists say that people who and businesses who migrate in search of better lives are, quote, voting with their feet. There are many reasons for such migrations, but sometimes an element of attraction is a better fiscal deal, better government services, lower taxes, or the consequence of a long series of government policies that have made the state or country, like New Zealand, more attractive to some people or businesses. All of this competition, horizontal, undoubtedly puts competitive pressure on the states to perform better. Now, competition has its own costs, and I'm not arguing that competition always delivers the best of all possible worlds, but I am arguing against the opposite extreme position, which is that interstate competition is always detrimental to good government. And to show you that I don't have a straw man here, let me quote again from Secretary of the Treasury, Ken Henry. Competitive federalism asserts there is a national interest in fostering subnational decision-making in respect to things that are of national importance. Proposition is that while competition among subnational governments will initially produce a number of different policy models, that same competition will eventually produce convergence on a model better than what any national government would likely be able to design and or implement. Continuing, so is competitive federalism the reason why nationally operated trains have to be equipped with 8 different radios? Does competitive federalism explain why we have such a plethora of inconsistent state-based regulatory requirements for occupational licensing, occupation health and safety, water transport, water trading and so on? Possibly, Dr. Henry continues, but there is a more likely explanation. Stubborn parochial interests in putting the welfare of the state or territory ahead of that of the nation. Parochialism, Dr. Henry says, is understandable, but a proper accounting of its national economic consequences would be weighed heavily in the negative. And that's the end of the quotation. Now, there is something in the claim that state politicians and bureaucrats are too parochial, too captured by local and state interests, whereas federal politicians and bureaucrats have a broader, a national point of view. But to me, there is a rather anti-democratic tone here. The feds, it seems to imply, can run more easily roughshod over the various inconvenient interests, be they local, regional, industrial, occupation, or the passionate supporters of a particular parrot, possum or wombat. But in fact, the states have not always stubbornly put parochial ahead of national interests. In the 1980s, far-ranging reforms and competition policy offered prospect for significant national-wide gains from coordinated action. The states pushed for cooperative reform and came to the party and signed an intergovernmental agreement on national competition policy. More recently, the initial impetus, which was then called the New Reform Agenda, now the National Productivity Agenda, the new initial impetus for coordinated efforts to improve the long-term economic and social prospects of Australians by reform in health and education, initial impetus came from Victoria. Earlier I mentioned tax, and let me go back to that briefly. Competition works best when there is a close relationship between the costs and the rewards of the actors, when a competitor's costs and rewards are closely connected. Competition is unlikely to further the social good when the relationship between cost and reward is vague or broken. In ordinary markets, that means that polluters should pay for the cost of their pollution, for example. Similarly, for intergovernmental competition to be most beneficial, there should be a close relationship between the costs and the rewards of a specific government action. In particular, it improves electoral accountability if, when a state wants to increase its own spending on things it wants to spend on, the state treasury can only go to one source of funding, namely the state's own taxes and charges. Contrawise, every time a state reduces its taxes and charges, then it should reduce its spending. Every time it reduces its spending, it could give tax relief if that's what it wants. But this close connection doesn't happen in Australia, and I'm not sure that it can happen unless the Commonwealth distributes all revenue grants to the states. Remember, I said Commonwealth has exclusive control over very substantially yielding taxes for quite good reasons from tax theory. This close connection between actions and rewards and costs won't happen unless the Commonwealth distributes all of its revenue grants to the states by a general formula like that used to distribute the GST monies. The states raise taxes and charges to cover about half of their spending or so, receive the other half from the Commonwealth, but the payments from the Commonwealth are not independent of the actions of the state. In particular, the Commonwealth enters into arrangements with individual states that blur state incentives and accountability. Recently, these arrangements have been partly codified into a system of national partnership payments, but this codification doesn't make it clear to electors who is paying for what, and it weakens the fiscal discipline on the states, because the states have a lobbying process by which they can get more money instead of going to their own citizens. Now, the evidence is that state governments are by and large content with the situation in which the Commonwealth collects much more tax revenue than it spends and sends a surplus to the states. But it presents a bit of a puzzle. What's the political payoff for the Commonwealth? Taxing too much. If the Commonwealth were only interested in the national interest, then maybe it would be content with the realisation that the assignment of tax types that I've mentioned is roughly in accord with good economic design and is in the national interest. Assign to the states those taxes that are costly to escape by moving interstate, for example, and assign other kinds to the Commonwealth. But doesn't seem to be content with that. It seems to be in the political interest of the Commonwealth to claim credit for services and facilities that it's funded, naturally. But it has deleterious effects, the chief of which is that voters are confused as to who is doing the funding of what. And the states have many ways to seek extra funding through the Commonwealth. And it has the more subtle effects that I mentioned earlier, that there are too many public institutions and agencies with more than one government master, which makes for confused lines of accountability and responsibility. So I come to my final remarks. Today I've argued that intergovernmental competition, vertical or horizontal, brings benefits, and I've acknowledged that it brings costs. The critics easily see the costs, but tend to ignore or dismiss the benefits. I've stressed and maybe stretched, maybe overstretched, the analogy between competition in ordinary business markets and intergovernmental competition in the political market. In that context, I've suggested that some forms of vertical competition between the Commonwealth and states, especially selective intervention, is unlikely to be socially beneficial. More beneficial is competing using structurally different ways of doing things, with institutions or instrumentalities fully controlled by and responsible to one government. It's the kind of things you get in business. You don't get business having another business coming in and taking over some of its products. There is a case for limiting tax competition by assigning personal and company income tax exclusively to the Commonwealth, in order to improve the efficiency of the tax system. And in the past, I think I put more emphasis on that from the background I came from. But the methods by which the surplus Commonwealth funds are distributed to the states reduce the independence, autonomy, responsibility and capacity of the states. Partly, or maybe mainly in consequence, the states have not performed well, and this has opened up scope for the Commonwealth. What one must fear is that the nature and form of common intervention will cause the states to become less competent, less accountable, and less able to provide effective and productive intergovernmental competition. End of talk.
We have some time for some questions. If anybody would like to ask some questions, could I ask any questioners to go to the microphones on either side of the theatre? Don't fall over in the dark. If there are any people from Treasury here, I'd ask them to identify themselves.
Not guilty on that one. Professor Pinkus, thanks very much for your offering. A couple of centuries ago, a textbook came across my bows which suggested that politics purges the system. It was an American textbook on federalism. And it also made the observation that politics went well beyond the art of the possible to, frankly, who gets what, when and how. Can you give us your definition of politics, please?
Oh, gosh. When I went to University of Queensland, I was told that politics were the authoritative distribution of goodies amongst people, exactly who gets what, when and how. So I probably can't give you a useful definition of politics. I can give you a useful definition of economics, if that will do. Economics is a social science which studies the exchange of things in all its various manifestations. And I suppose in that sense, I don't see a sharp distinction between studying politics and studying economics, because although politics has behind it the notion of authoritarianism, that is, the state is allegedly in control of the ultimate force, it can go out and arrest you and have you put in jail or even in some places shot, my reading of politics is that a lot of economics seems to apply to it too. That is, there are a lot of bargaining and exchange going on. So, yes, it may be the case, as you say, that it's about who gets what and where, which is an authoritative kind of way of distributing things rather than an exchange way of a way of bargaining, which is the way that economics prefers. I think a lot of politics still has tremendous amount of bargaining. Mentioned the national competition policy, which was very beneficial on average to Australians. There was a lot of bargaining that went on there. The Commonwealth didn't sit down and say, for the national good, you will do this. So my answer is no. But there are some people who know who are in the audience who could give you a good answer on what politics is.
I don't want to hog the floor, but didn't Menzies talk unceremoniously about economists? That God bless them, we need them, if only for the variety of their opinions.
Which is exactly right. Exactly right. Economics is not a religion or an insight into truth. Economics is a way of arguing. It's a way of arguing. And if all economists came to the right answer, I think something would be mad.
Thank you for...
I'll go to the other side first.
Thank you. I'm not from Treasury and I'm not an economist. I think I could understand your argument on horizontal competition between the states. After all, different states could establish different priorities. Some could give more emphasis to health, others to education, different levels of taxation and so on. And voters can decide which they prefer. But I have difficulty in understanding your concept of vertical competition and in particular your analogy with a market. After all, where the central government is largely responsible for funding the state governments, how can you see this as a market with competition between the two?
It's a very good question. Let me just give a go over a little bit again the example I gave of vertical competition where the states might compete with the federals. I don't know what the federal government's going to do about public hospitals if I read in the newspaper this morning what Tony Abbott said, he was health minister for 7 years, so I suppose he must have thought about it. He says that when Mr. Howard talked about how bad the state hospitals were, then said, but people, you wouldn't want all the hospitals run from Canberra, to which Mr. Abbott says, unfortunately, he, Mr. Howard, neglected to observe that Canberra bureaucrats would no more try to run public hospitals than they run nursing homes, which are Commonwealth funded, completely funded by the Commonwealth, and regulated by the Commonwealth, but are privately run. I suppose this must be Mr. Abbott's latest hospital plan, which will have privately run public hospitals. My point is that just because the Commonwealth funds something, it doesn't mean that it has to run it. Just because the Commonwealth funds the states to a substantial extent doesn't mean it has to run it. You can have the capacity for independent action even if you're funded by somebody else. If the Commonwealth, let's hope it doesn't, takes over all the public hospitals and runs them all from Canberra, which I don't think it'll do, but if it did, then my argument is vertical competitive federalism would be that voters may say to the states, why don't you try some different system? Why don't you try the system that used to be run, which was local public hospital boards with broad guidelines from the state running reasonably independently? They're not private institutions, but they're semi-autonomous institutions. So the fact that the Commonwealth funds the states, I think, does have deleterious effects. But the deleterious effects are both that on both sides. That is, the Commonwealth feels free to interfere selectively, as I called it, cherry-picking, into what the states are responsible. And the states, instead of saying, we're in a fix, we have to go to our voters and ask them for more money, run off to Canberra and say, oh, you've got this program, why don't you give us this money and we'll report to you rather than to our voters. So vertical competition is certainly harder to arrive at in a situation where the Commonwealth has the big stick. But let's take the GST. Up till now, I'm not saying now, but up till now, GST has been distributed to the states and they can do what they like with it. Now, some time ago when putting in a submission to the Senate about how GST money should be redistributed, I suggested that the Commonwealth should, hive off that portion of the GST monies that the Commonwealth Grants Commission allocates differentially to the states on account of remote Indigenous Aboriginal population, and just deal with that as not a lawyer, but I suspect under the 1967 Constitutional Amendment, the Commonwealth could deal with that money itself. But it has been the case that the huge amount of money goes to the states, and up till now, by and large, the states have had capacity to make a decision about how they deal with that. You may say they've done it badly, or may say they've done it well, but it is possible to have central funding and still have some untied money, we call it in economics, not tied to specific performance. It's not easy, but it's possible.
Yeah, it's your market analogy, which I think you have difficulty in persuading people.
Oh, gosh, yeah, sure. The market there is the customer. Customer markets are the things I'm interested in. The customers are the people who want a public hospital. And instead of having a single supplier of public hospital, whether they do it by providing it themselves or whether they do it by funding it all and setting a single regulation, have a single form of public hospital, that's a monopoly form. The market analogy is, well, there are other suppliers of public hospital regulations, public hospital arrangements, the states. We do have those. We have most private hospitals are not for-profit hospitals. We don't like those things. Most private hospitals are not-for-profit type hospitals. At least most hospital patients in non-government hospitals, I think, are in those. So there are other ways of doing it. It is just avoid, if you can, unless you've got a really good reason, having a single supplier of something. And vertical competition is to enable the state to do something the Commonwealth's doing, but maybe not catering to a certain range of population, just like a business will carve out a niche in the market by saying, ah, there's a group over there who aren't really being well looked after, we'll look after them.
Thank you.
Okay, a question over here. A question.
My question requires a little bit of background. The not background I'm offering happens to be the tests that we're going to watch tonight. That means that the whole of the world...
next week.
This is where this analogy just might find an answer. Kerry Packer broke up a monopoly, a world monopoly, cricket, and we were part of it. The ABC was one leg, and Lord's was the second leg. Now, if we use Kerry Packer and work through, and I would imagine 100% of the people listening to me would say they were quite familiar with the cricket and how it's worked out. Now, if we use this analogy of Kerry Packer breaking up a monopoly and spreading throughout the world and giving us the great joy, we have got outside of economics. Economics is not a cosmos. Economics happens to be a useful thing, and we all will use it to the best of our ability. But tell me, what if we took Kerry Packer as our cosmos? And then start to say, if he could do that, surely the mess we've got that's called Australia, which I very much doubt. So I'm offering you this suggestion, using Kerry Packer's attack on a monopoly, a cosmos, how could we use his example to get out of the mess we're in?
Well, I regard that as a friendly question in this house. I suppose it'd be called a Dorothy Dixer, but I didn't set it up. Let me say one thing first, which is that competition sometimes leads to awful results, results that any sensible person wouldn't want to have. I'm not saying that always competition is a terrific idea. Sometimes it's a terrible idea. It does depend on the conditions under which competition takes place, and all good forms of competition are regulated competition, and Australia, by and large, has done a pretty good job in that respect. So I'm really doing myself an easy job. I'm trying to avoid either extreme, the extreme which says that competition between governments is always bad. Competition that Mr. Kerry Packer introduced may or may not be good. I'm sorry, I haven't studied the matter well enough to know whether there are more people annoyed by the fact that the ABC doesn't show it. Thank goodness for SBS, I guess. But maybe more people annoyed by what Packer did than you are. You seem to like it. I don't know what the outcome of competition is going to be. It may sometimes be terrible, but the notion that it's always terrible and therefore it should always be gotten rid of is what I'm attacking. I'm trying to avoid both extremes. So I'm happy to take the analogy of Mr. Packer. He's dead, so we couldn't get him to do anything for us any longer, but he broke up a cosy set of arrangements. Most monopolies in markets of two kinds. There's a usually temporary monopoly which results from a competitive process where somebody is so much better than everybody else that they dominate the market. And it may be that what I mentioned in the talk, economies of scale, they can do mass things so cheaply that nobody else can get in. We call those in economics natural monopolies. They're rare. The most monopolies in in private business are artificial monopolies. They're monopolies that have been generated by various means, sometimes illicit private action, sometimes illicit government action. My plea is, think about the conditions under which monopolies tend to be good. Monopolies tend to be good when they become monopolies because a single supplier can do it much better than everybody else and has proven that in competition. Not proven it by mere assertion to say, we can do it better.
Okay. If there's no last question, no very last question, I'd ask you to join me in thanking our lecturer for a stimulating lecture.
Thank you.